Welcome to the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm Yannis Papadakis, business development manager at CREXI and today's host. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics and conversations with featured experts to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news in commercial real estate. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome and thank you all for joining us for this episode of the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. In this show, we cover a broad range of topics that cater to both commercial real estate newcomers and industry leaders alike. I'm your host, Yannis Papadakis, Business Development Manager at CREXI. And today we're thrilled to sit down with Jigar Desai and King Jeremiah of New Gen Advisory. A little bit about our guests. Jigar, or Jay Desai, joined the New Gen Advisory team of Arizona in 2017. He is focused throughout the southwestern regions of Texas to California, assisting clients with all their hotel and lodging transactional needs. Before joining the New Gen team, Jay was immersed in the financing and lending world with a large national bank, giving him a unique view into the lending world and providing the connections that allowed his clients to seek out financing even for the most challenging assets. Jigar graduated from the University of Arizona in 2011, attaining a dual degree from Eller College of Management in Finance and Real Estate. Jigar is a member and ambassador for the Asian American Hotel Owners Association and holds certifications for Choice Hotels and Best Western and owns a few hotels himself. He has been in the hotel industry since the age of 9, working alongside his parents, learning all sides of operations. King Jeremiah brings more than 30 years' experience in the hotel business to the New Gen Advisory team in Arizona. He has a passion for hospitality, service, and a global perspective based on his work with hoteliers across the United States and more than 80 countries. King began his career in hospitality in his home country of Grenada in the Caribbean. During his years at Berea College in Kentucky, he coupled his studies in business administration and hotel management with practical work experience at the historic Boone Tavern Hotel. After graduating with his master's degree from Eastern Kentucky University, King continued as general manager and sales director for many hotels in Kentucky. Starting in 2000, King joined Best Western Hotels and Resorts, where he held key corporate positions in consulting, branding, training, and quality assurance for over 4,000 hotels. Throughout his career, King has received many industry-leading designations, which include Certified Hotel Administrator, Certified Hospitality Trainer, and Certification in Hotel Industry Analytics. He's also actively involved in the hospitality industry as a member of the National Association of Black Hotel Owners, Operators, and Developers, Asian American Hotel Owners Association, and the Latino Hotel Association. Both, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So
thanks for having us.
I know we just covered a bit about both of your backgrounds, but I'd love to briefly hear more about your career paths and lesson learns along the way. Can you tell us a little more about where you're from and how you started in commercial real estate and hospitality in particular?
No, I graduated from the University of Arizona, go Wildcats. I had a degree in finance and real estate. Upon graduation, I started work for a pretty large bank down here in Arizona, and I took whatever job that came to me at that time. When I graduated in 2011, the job market wasn't that great. Less than 50% of my class had some type of a job when they graduated college. So whatever came in my lap, I pretty much took. And it was a great experience. You know, it wasn't something I wanted to do for the rest of my life. Working for the bank, I learned a lot on the business side of things, lending side of things, operations, and management. I also had my real estate license while I was going to college at the age of 18, but never really used it. So I was kind of staying inactive at that time. So a good friend of mine, Dan, who was one of the partners and owners of New Gen Advisory and founders, approached me while I was an ambassador for him, working with the Asian American Hotel Owners Association. He said, "Hey, why don't you come work for me?" At that time, I was like, you know what, Dan, I don't know if I can, you know, put much time into it. I don't know, you know, what it's going to entail. I'm working full time. So, you know what, I took the opportunity and, you know, started working for the bank and also started doing real estate at the same time simultaneously. You know, upon, you know, the items that I learned from the bank in terms of management, operations, lending, and also working in the hotel since the age of 9 alongside with my parents, you know, getting into the hospitality real estate field was pretty easy, you know, doing a few transactions myself for the family and knew all the bits and pieces around it. So once I joined, you know, I think I found my passion at that time and it just went on from there. And then after that, I let the bank job go and, you know, I was able to close my first deal within a few months of joining the firm. And ever since then, it's been history.
Nice. And King, a little bit, could you expand a little bit about yours?
Sure. So as mentioned earlier, you know, I am from the island of Grenada. And Grenada, you know, one of the things people say about Grenada is that the people there are very friendly and we have a great sense of hospitality. But when I started college, I was working at the Boone Tavern Hotel because everyone at Berea College has to work at least 10 hours a week. So that's where I got my taste of hospitality. And so I continued that throughout college, grad school, and then after I graduated, started working at a Best Western hotel. But then 5 years into that, I got hired in at Best Western corporate office and essentially did consulting and quality assurance for 20 years. And then when COVID hit, you know, because I was doing a lot of international travel, you know, at that time, you know, my position was initially furloughed. And then after 6 months, it was determined that, you know, we're not going to do in that position the way that it had been done in the past. So then I started looking for other opportunities, started working with a hotel broker, learned the business while I was there, and then got my real estate license. And I figured at the time with a real estate license, you can do commercial, any commercial or residential, but quickly discovered that at my heart, I am a hotel guy, I'm a hospitality guy, and residential was not my thing. So I went to the AHOA convention in Baltimore in 21, or was that 22? No, 22, and yeah, met the New Gen team there and mentioned to them that, hey, I would love to be able to sell hotels with you guys. They said, hey, when we get back to Phoenix, stop by, let's have a chat. And, you know, joined in May of last year. And have been working with New Gen ever since. And it's a great position, a great opportunity for me, and I love it.
It's great to hear. I'm curious to know, who were some of your mentors along the way, and how did they shape your career paths, either earlier or later in your career? Jay, why don't we start with you?
Yeah. Some of the mentors, definitely, like I said, you know, starting at a young age, working in hotels, my parents, for example, you know, since I was a young child, they got me trained in all of the different areas of the hotel. You know, I would come home from school and I would help them, you know, off my off time, you know, with the front desk, cleaning rooms, or even learning maintenance. So I was able to gain a lot of skills during my off time, you know, after school and on during the weekends, during my young years, you know, which has helped me, you know, tremendously along the way. Another mentor of mine, you know, Dan Rama, her partner in New Gen again, you know, took me under his wing when he was with the AHOA. You know, he saw my passion in hotels that I had at the age of 16 when I first met him. And, you know, he brought me in as an ambassador. And after that, you know, just saw what I was doing and got me into real estate and finally guided a path that, you know, I love doing. So those are a few mentors along the way that I've, you know, definitely been able to accomplish.
Okay, so in my case, I would say one of my main mentors was my academic advisor at college. So he was the general manager of the Boone Tavern Hotel. And as we were talking about, you know, what I need to be doing in college, and I was a business administration major, he said, King, you know, given that you are from the Caribbean, I would strongly recommend that you specialize in hotel management. That way, if you ever go back to the island, or actually he said, when you go back to the island, then you can find a great job in a hospitality business. And so I took that to heart, you know, and got my degree in business administration, but specialized in hotel management. And I think it is there that I learned and developed a passion for hospitality, working at Boone Tavern Hotel in the restaurant and also at the front desk, and just learning more about hospitality. Then later on, when I started working for Best Western, you know, a great mentor of mine, it was my boss for many, many years. His name is Bruce Weinberg, you know, and we learned a lot together and we helped develop the international program for Best Western. And we had great successes together. And he taught me a lot, but we also worked side by side. And it was a great experience working together.
Excellent. Were there any lessons that you learned early on in your careers that, you know, helped course correct you, or let's call them favorite mistakes that were made that kind of helped, you know, put you on the path?
Yeah, I definitely learned a lot, especially during my college years. You know, everyone makes mistakes, and then you learn from that, right? You know, the one thing that I, you know, characterize on, and I tell all the people that are in college and school and things nowadays, is do something that you're passionate about. You know, I know, you know, going to school, you know, people want to become doctors and your lawyers, you know, they want to do these things, but find a good fit that you want to do, find something you're passionate about and just go for it. I think that's going to take you, you know, in a successful career. That's going to bring, you know, you something that you'll love doing on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, look at me, I found my passion a little bit later than I wish I could have, but it took me to greater heights and I love what I do. You know, I love a lot of my clients that, you know, I've transacted hotels on, you know, it's just not about selling hotels and whatnot. It's a lot of the transactions that I've done with my clients that have turned into family now, and just seeing their successes has been, you know, rewarding. Just finding that passion and just, you know, following it from an earlier start is what's going to be successful.
Yeah, and I would say one great lesson I learned was make sure that you're clear about what others are expecting from you. And I had one situation when I was working at Best Western where I thought that the direction was that we need to get more input from our hoteliers on a particular subject matter. So I was leading a meeting, brought the topic up, you know, and discussed certain things that maybe was not intended to be discussed in that particular way. And so, you know, after my report was produced, it was, why did we bring that up with the members? And I thought, well, I thought that's what you wanted. But I think from that experience, I think I learned that, hey, you need to make sure that before you move out and launch out in any particular direction, that you are clear as to what is being expected of you and not assume that you need, that something is being expected, but make sure that you know what exactly is being expected.
And then what are some fundamental tenets of your work ethic that you maintain today? Do you have any daily habits or practices that have become essential to your career? And it can be commercial real estate related or otherwise, like meditation.
Yeah, for me, I'm more of a list guy, you know. So, you know, I plan out my, you know, the next day, you know, the day before, plan out my week, the week before. And I'm always, you know, writing down lists or using sticky notes on my computer, saying, hey, these are my to-do lists. And that's what I stay by and follow because that's my end goal of things that I need to get done. The other thing for me is, you know, I hate sitting around. You know, I'm always grinding. I love staying busy. I love talking to people. So especially when it comes to like special events for people, birthdays, or if I'm, you know, driving, you know, on vacation with the family and there's a, you know, person that I know that I did a transaction with or somebody that I know that owns a hotel, I usually maybe even stop by for about 5-10 minutes just to stop and say hello, say hi. A lot of my clients like that. I enjoy it. I just love meeting people, you know, and whenever it's, you know, people's important days on Facebook or, you know, when I get reminders, I always take, you know, a couple minutes out throughout my day and just call them, whether it's, you know, business related or not. You know, it's just, you know, keeping up and just doing follow-ups with my clients. And that's what I love, you know, just checking in with them and just seeing how happy they are and where they are with, you know, from, you know, becoming a client to a good family friend now.
Nice.
You know, for me, I would say being responsive, because, you know, many times someone may send you an email, a text or something like that, and you may think that it is, you can wait. You can wait a couple hours to respond, but you never know what that person might be doing right now or how important that information is to them right now. And so I try to respond to any request that I receive as soon as possible so that, you know, that information is out there. And I think that was one of the things that I learned from one of my mentors, you know, that you want to respond as quickly as possible so that your customer is not waiting on information from you. That you're never the bottleneck in the information flow.
Good advice. I know that especially in this industry, there is, it's definitely something to be said for people that can get back to you quickly and efficiently and provide information to you in a timely manner. You know, I've experienced that myself when I was on the brokerage side of the fence. It really does impress people when you're, you know, right on the spot. So moving along onto our second topic, getting more into the nuts and bolts of our topic today, let's talk about all things hospitality. What are the 101 essentials of hospitality? And for those unfamiliar with the sector, what do operators or potential investors need to know about the industry from a day-to-day perspective?
Yeah, I mean, look, anybody can invest in a hotel, and there are plenty of ways of creating that opportunity, right? Buyers just need to understand the market that they're getting into. Some things are that they need to look at are demand generators of the hotel. What types of business are brought in? Is it business? Is it leisure? Is it tourism? Is it, you know, corporate companies that are in the area, construction workers? What is it? There's also reports such as STR reports that buyers can easily gauge and tell if the property is performing or underperforming, and what can be possibly be done to revamp that if it's underperforming. You know, what are some ideas or you know, additional amenities that can be offered in a hotel that can be turned around if a buyer was to get in place. Some of the other items is operational costs of running the hotel and the debt that's going to be needed to fund the project to get to the bottom line. You know, right now costs have been going up over the last few years, you know, especially with payroll and utilities, and especially debt. Interest rates have been, you know, constantly on the rise. So those are a lot of the, you know, numbers that buyers will need to understand to make, you know, is this investment going to be worth it? Is it going to pencil at this price? You know, those are some of the items that need to be considered. And definitely, you know, what is their upside? You know, what can be done differently? You walk into a hotel, you know, there's a hotel for sale. You look at it, you look at the numbers, you look at the financials, but you're not going to understand it until you actually go visit the property, visit the market. You know, once you spend a night there or two and, you know, go around town and go visit around and talk to a few people, maybe you can create some upside. What can be done differently? You know, again, there's no right and wrong, but, you know, there's plenty of ways of creating that opportunity for buyers.
So I think the answer depends on whether or not the person is getting into the business, one, as an owner-operator or simply as an investor. Because as an owner-operator, one of the fundamental things you have to keep in mind is that this is a business that is open 24/7, 365 days a year. So it will change your life. You know, if you're, even if you're not living on site, you know, the possibility of being called in to deal with an emergency or a situation at odd hours of the night or any given day, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, you know, so that is something that if you're looking to get into the business that you need to understand that this is definitely a possibility. Now you can, of course, hire people to take care of some of those things for you. But even if you have a general manager, if there is a situation that happens with the general manager, and then you as the owner may have to step in and take charge there. Now, if you're simply investing as an investor, you have to understand, I think, the cyclical nature of the business. And that sometimes, you know, even within the year, in some markets, the summertime is your high season, so you're going to be doing very well. But then in the wintertime, then you might be quite slow. And so you want to make sure that you are saving money and during the summertime to pay your mortgage or something that during the wintertime, do not just spend it all as it is coming in. So just understanding those two key fundamentals, and I think is important for either the owner, operator, or the investor.
Thank you. Now, I take it the sector has evolved quite a bit over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, especially after the pandemic. Can you talk a little bit about some of those shifts, you know, any key fundamental shifts, who are staying in these hotels? I mean, we touched on that a little bit. And what are guest expectations and how have they changed?
Yeah, I mean, at, you know, some of our hotels where we're based at, where after, you know, during COVID hit, you know, now we're back to the norm, and we're getting many different types of clientele of people. You know, we have a lot of base of people that are utilizing hotels, such as family travelers, business travelers. We're getting groups back now, and leisure travelers, you know. But the guest expectations have come a long way, especially, you know, since COVID, especially in the world of technology, right? Guests are utilizing their phones a lot more than they used to. You know, hotels are not having these self-check-in kiosks where guests can just walk in without, you know, greeting a front desk agent and just checking themselves using these virtual kiosks, get their room key, and they're on their way. For example, Hilton, Marriott, and some of these other brands, they've come out with RFID keys where you can check in, you know, when you're a Bonvoy customer or Hilton Honors member, and check in online on your phone, and you'll get sent an RFID key. And you don't even need to go to the front desk. You can just take your cell phone, go straight to your room number, and then hold your phone up to the door, and the door's open. You know, guests just want a simple, you know, clean stay. A lot of guests are also utilizing, you know, there's AI, artificial intelligence, where there's chatbots now, where they're able to chat directly with the front desk if they need any housekeeping service or linens, or if they're having issues with their rooms, without, you know, getting out of the bed and coming, you know, to the front office. You know, these guests are able to do all these things, you know, the comfort of their bed, especially in infotainment, you know, TVs, you know, in the guest rooms. A lot of the brands are moving towards, you know, things such as offering Netflix, Hulu. You know, people can bring in their own devices and cast on their phone and watch TVs. So there's a lot of technology components that hotels have been needing to adapt to and are adapting to, you know, for the future.
No, I think along the same lines with technology, even though many hotels are adopting new technology, I think from the guest perspective, they still appreciate the human touch. So they do not want to have a stay where, you know, they have zero interaction. But if they need to interact with a human, then they want to make sure that they're not having to wait long lines to get to an individual simply because a hotel has adopted so much technology that, and the staff, the headcount is so low now that the guests have to wait long times in lines to get simple questions answered. So this is still a hospitality business, and while technology may be able to help facilitate it, I think as an owner operator, we need to keep in mind that the guest still expects a human interaction and a human touch. And we have to make sure that we have that right balance between technology as well as what the guest is expecting. Now, in some cases, in many hotels have opted to make like housekeeping optional, but some guests, they still want their rooms clean every day. And so we want to make sure that if a guest wants that option, and that they can get it without having to jump through many hoops in order to request it or to have that expectation met.
How has hospitality competed with upstarts like Airbnb, you know, VRBO? What changes have occurred as a result of those entering the space, or have there been any changes?
Yeah, look, and I'll agree with King on this as well too. You know, especially with the hotels, I am seeing a lot of guests that kind of went away from using hotels and gone towards Airbnb when Airbnb, VRBO, HomeAway, and those, you know, websites came out. And a lot of these same guests that we used to have that come to our hotels are coming back to the properties now, are getting away from Airbnb and HomeAway and VRBO because of having a staff on site. Yes, with the technology point and things being there, there's been a lot of issues that I've been hearing from guests stating that, hey, if there's ever issues with, you know, some of the rentals that they have, there's no 24/7 support. There's no, you know, long wait times on the phone, or it's hard to get a hold of the owner after hours if there's any issues going on with the hotel. You know, whether it's utilizing the technology aspect of it or walking up to the front desk, their needs are taken care of right away. Secondly, a guest knows exactly what kind of service, what kind of room, what kind of amenities that they're going to be getting by staying at a hotel versus staying at different Airbnbs, because not all of them are all the same. you know, if a you know, guest is, you know, a dedicated brand loyal customer to brand A, they know that they're going to get that level of service, level of room and everything from wherever they go, you know, throughout city to city. The other thing that I've been, you know, conversational with guests is Airbnbs have, you know, increased their payments on security cleaning fees now. And, you know, sometimes they're able to get cheaper stays, but with their security cleaning fees and other additional fees added in, it turns out to be a lot more than hotels now. So I think we're definitely, you know, able to compete a lot better, even though they're also, you know, being featured on a lot of these OTA websites that we are on, you know, for example, booking.com and Expedia, where they're, you know, housing Airbnb and houses and stuff along with hotels. But guests are, you know, realizing, you know, what the differences are and what their kind of level of service that they're definitely going to be getting.
Especially if the guest is someone who is looking for maybe a full service type experience, you know, where they can just get up in the morning, go downstairs and have breakfast, or, you know, have lunch or dinner or go to the bar. You know, and with many VRBOs or Airbnb, you know, you do everything yourself. So if you're booking that as your vacation, you may ask yourself, wait a minute, that's the same thing I do at home. I need a break. You know, I don't want to have to do dishes. I don't want to have to cook and figure out those kinds of things like that. Whereas you can have the convenience of those things and those services right there at a hotel if you're staying at, you know, a hotel that offers those services. So I think the human interaction and having staff available to take care of your needs is a great plus for the hotels. And so hotels should definitely not be looking to use that as their sole means of reducing their costs. Because if there is no difference between the hotel experience and the Airbnb or VRBO, then guests may not feel the need to stay at the hotel. And they may just continue to seek out, you know, the experiences at the Airbnb.
It sounds like the hospitality aspect of hotels is really what's kind of coming back. I mean, I can speak from personal experience. I did the exact same thing when Airbnb first started popping up. It definitely was attractive, you know, of, you know, being able to have what may seem like a larger space for, comparable pricing. But after a while, you know, I started missing, you know, having somebody clean my room for me and, you know, making the bed and changing the sheets and having fresh towels and all that stuff. And I think another thing that may play into this as well is, you know, as regulation has made its way into Airbnb and VRBO, you know, inevitably it's become more expensive for those operators to operate, and they've had to pass, you know, those expenses on to the travelers as well. So, you know, you really do start to kind of stack and compare, okay, what do I get for what I'm paying for in each scenario? And it seems like the hotel experience is really just kind of outweighing the amenities and the benefits that you get over, you know, staying at an Airbnb. And then something else that you mentioned, Jay, that I think really nails it is, you know, the consistency of experience that you get from a hotel versus, you know, somebody's house, you know, somebody's place. You know, you don't exactly know, you know, if their washer a clean washer. You know, I once stayed at an Airbnb where the clothes came out of the washer dirtier than they went in. What's going on here? But I think you hit on some really important points to consider. Now, King, speaking to the franchise side of hotel operations and your experience there, how does hotel franchising work, and what do potential investors need to know about franchises?
Okay, well, great. So I guess the franchise system or the franchise model allows an investor to invest in a piece of, in a real estate or in a business where they know what they can get and what there's a level of consistency in there, and where whether it is a Days Inn or a Choice branded hotel, that they know that guests who are booking their particular hotel would have a level of expectation because that is what the brand has committed to. So when someone is looking online and they're saying, okay, I'm going to this city, if they're loyal to that brand, then that guest knows what that brand has to offer. And so that is attractive to many guests because, as we were talking about just recently here, about, you know, the inconsistencies of the Airbnb experience. And so by having the franchise and the brand, it gives you that consistency, and then you know exactly what you're going to be getting. The other thing is that the brands have a commitment to the franchisees that they are going to be marketing the hotels on the owner's behalf. Now, again, we shouldn't make that the only form of marketing that is being done, but as the owner, you need to market your hotel the way that is appropriate for your location. Now, there are two different types of franchises. You have some of them where they are very strict on their standards, meaning that if on breakfast they say that you have to have 3 breads like this, this, and this, that's the only type of breads you can have. There are other types where they say you need to have at least 3 breads. So if you wanted to have 5, then that's okay. So then it gives you the option of being able to customize your breakfast and your experience to meet that guest need of the market where you are located. And so that's one of the things to keep in mind, whether you're looking at a franchise that is just one set of standards, fixed standards, or where they have minimum standards and give you the opportunity to customize your offering for your market.
Are there any drawbacks to going the franchise route? What would an entity need to consider if they decide to go the franchise route?
I would say a drawback is that the franchise basically tells you what the expectations are. They create guardrails around what is expected. So, you know, you cannot just go out and do whatever you want to do. And you have certain parameters that you have to stick within. And then also, some might see as a drawback that a certain percentage of the income that you're generating from your business has to be paid as royalty fees to the franchisor. So those are two things that you have to keep in mind. But again, unless you're buying or investing in a hotel that is already well known in the marketplace, you may need to work with a franchisor so that guests have that confidence that they can book your hotel and know exactly what they're getting.
Okay. Now, shifting gears a little bit, now that we understand a little bit more about what makes the, you know, hospitality's different aspects attractive as an investment, let's talk about the actual hospitality market today. Can you provide us with a 30,000-foot overview of the hospitality market, especially amid, you know, current macroeconomic trends such as inflation's impact, interest rates, labor shortages, consumer spending, et cetera? Let's talk a little bit about what we're seeing in today's market.
Yeah, transactions are still happening, you know, even this current economic climate that we're in. There's still, you know, a lot of plenty of lenders out there that are still lending in the hospitality space. Rates, like I said earlier, you know, they're constantly on the rise, but, you know, buyers and sellers are, you know, starting to factor that into the pricing of the sales. They're starting to factor that into operational costs for a buyer, what it's going to, you know, take to, you know, make money at the end of the year, you know, by paying this type of or taking this type of a debt on. And labor has come back in a lot of markets, and there's a lot of plenty of people looking for jobs. You know, during the pandemic, labor was a big issue for, you know, following, you know, post-COVID for another 2 years. And a lot of that can be resulted in a lot of government funding that has, you know, dried up now, forcing people to go back to work. And in terms of inflation, prices of hotel rates have gone up in all the markets, you know, and the reason being that is to offset, you know, the higher utility costs, higher taxes, higher payrolls that we as operators are facing. You know, even in, you know, this year, we have had a lot of phone calls from a lot more buyers than there's inventory on the market. You know, there's plenty of buyers out there all the way from, you know, 1031 exchange buyers that are looking for, you know, properties to multifamily buyers that want to, you know, convert hotels into multifamily for affordable housing or low income housing. You know, there's new mom and pop little motel buyers that are out there that wanting to convert some of these older class assets, you know, 20 room, 30 room motels to, you know, little independent boutique properties in some locations. Those are the visionary buyers. You know, there's still a lot of 1031s and conversions happening, you know, government entities picking up a lot of hotels that can be used for transitional housing or homeless housing or housing for asylum immigrants as well. These are some of the examples that some of the transactions that we've done. So the hospitality space, you know, has come a long way. And now we're just seeing a lot of different types of uses that are being utilized in terms of hotels. You know, older hotels are being revitalized, redeveloped, and, you know, all sorts of buyers are still tapping into the hospitality market.
And one of the things that I have seen is that we have a number of brands that are, that have launched initiatives to try to increase the diversity in the hotel ownership space. And so what that means is that now we are seeing a lot of new buyers, people who are not first-time buyers into the hospitality, and that are now in the market looking for hotels. Now, and in many cases, because it's a new industry for them, and they are very successful in other industries, but there is a bit of education that is needed with those buyers to understand the difference between the hospitality business and other businesses that they have been working in. Yeah, and so this gives us a great opportunity to help educate those new buyers, but it also helps us to create, it creates a market for new property, because oftentimes as a first-time buyer, they're not going to be looking at the high, you know, $10, $20 million purchases. And we want to make sure that they understand the business and buy an asset that can produce for them and provide a return that makes it a successful investment in the hospitality space.
Now, do you see any difference in hotel performance across markets, you know, class A versus class B or other variables, and what are they?
That's an interesting question, and I would say yes. And some of the things that we've seen, you know, let's take, for example, your 2020 COVID year. You know, a lot of markets were closing up. You know, some states had, you know, minimum occupancy or maximum occupancy rights where they had to say, you know, hotels can only rent X amount of rooms, or, you know, interior corridor hotels had to rent rooms, you know, every other room or something like that. And there, all these rules and regulations came out across the board in different markets. Here in Arizona, with the desert world that we live in, you know, we got hit with COVID, but it wasn't as bad as a lot of the other markets. And we saw a lot of travelers come from California and other states, come out here and come golfing or do tourist attractions or go hiking and biking and things like that. So for us, when COVID hit, it wasn't too bad for us. We were down for a couple months and we picked right back up again. You know, and then post COVID, you know, some of the larger markets, like now, for example, like this year, I've been talking to a lot of my clients that own properties in on beach cities, like in Virginia, and tourist attractions like, you know, Disneyland, for example, where summertime's a peak season for them, where they're sold out. And this year it's not a norm. It's, you know, they're running into low occupancy. Travelers aren't, you know, going as much anymore. They still have rooms available. People are fighting for rate in some of those markets. And a lot of that maybe have to do with inflation. People are maybe, you know, thinking about, you know, spending money. Who knows? But there's definitely a lot of different variables that have been happening, you know, since COVID and post-COVID now in different markets as well.
Yeah. And I think it has always been that, you know, depending on the location of the property, it could greatly impact, you know, the level of business. Now, one of the things that I think we see with the work from home situation, where many of the commercial office buildings may be under occupied right now, and that a lot of the hotels that depended heavily on that segment of the business, like the business traveler coming in, that they may have seen some impact because maybe they were doing more Zoom meetings and not as much people traveling, or maybe when they travel, they're not doing as frequent trips, but maybe they might spend longer, do more on a single trip. So I think some of those businesses might have seen an impact. But, you know, one of the fundamentals of this particular business and industry is location, location, location. So for a new person investing in this business, they want to make sure that they're looking for a property in a location that has good and multiple demand generators, that if one sector takes a slip, that they can pick up in another. So let's say if, you know, the business traveler goes down, then there are other leisure activities that they can rely on to fill their hotels.
Now, how has transaction velocity shifted in the last few years? Are we seeing more deals get done, fewer deals get done? Do you see deals getting done if we see some stagnancy in occupancy?
Yeah, I feel like deals are still happening. Deals are still being done. You know, especially this year, buyers and lenders are definitely looking at upside, you know, especially, you know, when it comes to getting debt for purchasing hotels. You know, a lot of the lenders that I've been working with over the last few years, you know, have reached out to me, you know, last year and this year and said, hey, Jay, we're maxed out on our hospitality bucket. We're not going to be able to do hotel loans for the next year or year and a half at least. So, you know, I had to go out and find more lenders that can get into, you know, that can do conventional lending or that can do United States, you know, Department of Agriculture lending if the hotel falls in that specific area, or find other creative ways of getting deals done, whether it's, you know, owner financing or maybe even lease to purchase options. A lot of the banks, you know, that we have relationships with, you know, are asking more than the typical 15% down payment that a lot of deals were being transacted upon in the previous years. Now they're looking at, you know, 20, 25% down. They're looking at possibly cross collateralizing a lot of deals. You know, if a buyer has multiple hotels, they may, you know, not only take the hotel that they're purchasing as a lien and maybe take another one that they may have. And, you know, a lot of lenders are also looking at, you know, the buyer's experience. You know, they're looking at their resumes, they're looking at their, you know, business plans, their proposals, their projections, who they are as an individual before they're lending on it. And this year, it's been interesting. I'm having, you know, the VP and presidents of some of these, you know, banks go out and visit the property themselves, stay the night, look at the town, and then, you know, give the okay back to the board saying that, hey, we're, you know, I feel comfortable lending on this asset. Right. So a lot of deals that we're doing, you know, it is taking a little bit more handholding this year, but, you know, we're also having a lot of our deals pre-approved with local banks as well to make sure that, hey, there's definitely financing available to qualified buyers if there is. So those are some of the things that I've seen change in the hospitality field.
Yeah. And in my experience, I am also seeing that more buyers are either asking for seller financing. And so they are looking, because they understand that many of the banks have that higher threshold for down payment or collateral that might be needed. And so they're looking for more seller financing opportunities. So one that signals is that if there are sellers out there who are already wanting to or needing to sell, if they have the opportunity to offer seller financing, and oftentimes it could be for as short as 2 years, sometimes 5 years at the most, and because the buyers are trying to say, hey, we want to be able to run this property for a while so we can show to the lender that we have been the one operating the property and that they can trust our numbers that we would be able to keep this property going because we've had, you know, 2 to 5 years of experience working at this property and have been making good on all of our debt service thus far. From the buyer's perspective, though, one thing that because of the higher collateral that is needed, we may need to see more partnerships and joint ventures, meaning that maybe you have a friend or a neighbor or somebody who you know who's also wanted to either get into the hotel business or maybe wanted to buy another hotel. And for the next couple of years, it may be helpful to maybe form an LLC with that individual or individuals and then go in together to buy the property. So because it's important to have control of the asset first, even though conditions may not be perfect for you to acquire it yourself, but having ownership of the asset in some way or another is very important. And the sooner you can do that, and the better that you would be able to ride the wave.
Got it. And I know we touched on this a little bit, Jay, but how will technological advances such as AI, different innovations shape the future of the hospitality sector?
Yeah, I mean, AI, you know, it's new, and a lot of the hotels and brands and you know, hotel operation companies are picking this you know, artificial intelligence topic up. And some of the brands, what they're doing, and some of these online travel agencies, you know, they're doing dynamic rate changing. You know, when consumers are looking at hotels, rates are automatically changing. You know, marketing of hotels, when, you know, guests are looking and surfing the web online, you know, artificial intelligence is being used on what they're looking for, what guests are looking for. And a lot of this data is being presented back to a lot of the brands or even these marketing companies where, you know, they're able to, you know, take it back to hotel ownership and let them know that, hey, these are the items that, you know, a lot of guests are looking for. And these are some of the changes that we shall make, right? So, you know, definitely AI is going to be a big thing, you know, especially with, you know, chat boxes as well, too. I think that's going to take the next step in the hotel industry for sure.
No, there's, of course, there are some jobs maybe at the corporate level that can be enhanced by AI. And maybe even at some of the local level, maybe like, you know, running your night audit reports and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, you know, this business is truly a people business, you know, because I have not seen any type of AI applications as yet that would go out, that is able to go out there, clean the room, you know, and that right. is still a human interaction and that is needed. But as operators, yes, we want to find and use the AI components that can take care of some of the more routine and mundane tasks so we can free up the individual so that they can have that personal interaction with the guests and not worrying about all of the things that can be done through automation or that maybe could be eliminated and be done at some point later in the life cycle of the guest stay.
And then finally, what are your primary considerations when advising hospitality clients through current economic times? What are the long-term upsides? What are the current obstacles? And then any words of advice, you know, generally speaking, for players in the space?
Yeah, you know, I think I touched on this a little bit earlier, you know, for, you know, current hospitality clients right now, just having a clean paperwork, right? Making sure that their property management system reports match with their profit and loss statements, and that matches with their bank account statements. You know, also the lending part of it, right? That I visited on earlier. Things are just getting a little bit more harder to get financing done, but it can still be done as long as you're qualified, having a clean slate of paperwork on your hand, making sure you know, your business plans are in place, your projections are in line with the market, and making sure you're running a clean, you know, operable hotel, you know, making sure it's presentable to whoever walks into the door, whether it's a guest or whether it's, you know, a banker or whoever it may be, or when you're, whenever you're even trying to sell the hotel, making sure, you know, it's presentable. And also, you know, keeping up with, you know, PIPs, right? You know, during COVID, you know, a lot of brands kind of backed away and didn't visit the hotels, and a lot of PIPs were ignored. And they said, you know what, during COVID, we'll let you get away with these things. But since then, you know, a lot of brands have been, you know, coming down and coming visiting the property. So making sure that, you know, the reviews are there, guests are happy, things for the guests are being taken care of, you know, guests' responses are being answered to, and just making sure you have a clean, presentable property from a day-to-day aspect.
No, another thing I think that many hotel investors, owners, operators need to be mindful of. You know, if you listen to the news, the media, you know, there is a lot of talk about, you know, not inflation, but also recession. You know, however, those are terms that you've been hearing a lot about even since 2020, that, you know, next quarter is going to be a recession, or next year is going to be a recession. And so sometimes I think people might react to that kind of news and maybe and either cut back in areas or do things that may be impacting the guest experience. We have to keep in mind that our main focus is to take care of the guests. You take care of the guests today, you have the things in place that will continue to take care of the guests, and the business, in a sense, will take care of itself. So do not is out of fear, you know, start cutting services and cutting your expenses at the expense of the guest experience. Because as Jigar mentioned, you know, if the guests are not getting the experience that they have, their reviews are going to reflect it. And then other guests are not going to be coming to your hotel. And so you kind of create, in a sense, a self-fulfilling prophecy of a recession or a reduction in business because you did things that kind of created the conditions that will have that effect on your business. So focus on taking care of the guests. Yes, there are things that your cost might be slightly higher, but if you invest in the guest experience, then it will pay itself off in the long run.
Great advice. Now, moving along to our fourth topic, given your backgrounds and expertise, I'm sure our listeners are curious about what your answers would be to a few rapid fire questions and some words of advice questions. Are you ready?
Sure.
Shoot.
All right. So if you were given $50 million today and had to invest it immediately, what would be your go-to asset type, location, and why?
$50 million. All right. This is what I would do. I diversify. I wouldn't buy just one hotel. You know, I diversify and put it into all different classes of hotels across different markets, such as purchasing a few extended stay properties from anywhere from economy extended stays to some higher brand extended stay products. I'd purchase, you know, invest into a couple economy brands, such as Independent Boutique and a couple of the higher brands as well. Locations would, you know, depend anywhere from college, university towns to larger metro cities that have a lot more than a few demand generators and possibly downtown districts. So that would be my good mix of hotels that I would buy with $50 million. You know, like I said, I'm passionate about the hotel industry. I own hotels myself. You know, I have a couple economy properties and my next play, you know, I believe in the extended stay market. So, you know, I definitely diversify. A lot of the things, you know, the reason I say diversification is some of these institutional clients that we have, you know, they only focus on the top tier brands, IHG, Hilton, Marriott. When COVID hit, those were the property that struggled the most. The economy brands and extended stay market didn't struggle as much. And a lot of these institutional buyers came back to us, you know, and said, hey, you know, find us some, you know, lower brand economy products that, you know, are cash flowing, or some extended stay products that are, you know, pretty much full in occupancy, right? So I think that was a good learning lesson during the year of COVID. And a lot of guys that started diversifying have been very successful. And that's something that I would, you know, do with $50 million now.
Excellent. Okay, I got to ask, King, what's going to be the 100th country you visit?
You know, at one point in time, I was trying to be very picky and trying to determine, you know, that maybe Colombia, maybe Brazil. But at this point in time, it would just be nice to say that I have been to 100 countries. So anyone that I have not been to, it would be a welcome addition, because it's been since 2019 since I visited my 99th country, which was Peru. So, you know, I'm open.
You're open. All right. You just want to hit that 100 mark.
Yes.
All right. Favorite tool or software that you're using on the job? And I promise this is not a trick question.
I got to say my cell phone. I'm always on the go, and that's my favorite tool that I can't live without on a day-to-day basis. For me, my phone is everything. It, you know, look, it's communication, whether it's text, email, phone, reminders, my list, everything. And like King said earlier, you know, just being responsive, right? Just having my phone on me, you know, in the middle of the night or, you know, weekends, you know, we're always working, you know, we as real estate agents. So, you know, just being responsive to our clients, whether it's a quick text, email, or whatever, we can do that from the go with our phone. And that would be my favorite tool.
Right. And I actually agree with Jay on that one. But also, it is important to have access to data, you know, and also to take a look at what else is available out there. And not because this is a Crexy podcast, but I use the Crexy website to find out what other properties out there are available so that I can help my clients identify properties that they might be interested in and help them to see if that property might be a good fit for their investment needs.
All right. And finally, what is the most common misconception about your job or industry?
Most common misconception. I love this. Everyone thinks what we do is very easy and we make a ton of money. So look, we work on a lot of deals simultaneously and deals take time, right? And some of the deals that we work on and transactions that we work on take maybe even over a year, and anything can go wrong in the middle, you know, where, you know, buyers back out last minute or appraisals may come in low or lenders may even back out at the end. Markets change, debt can change, you know, over the last year, interest rates have gone, you know, we were in the beginning of last year, we were doing deals at 3-4% interest rates and now they're, you know, nines and tens easy. So it's just bridging the balance between buyer and seller to get the deals across that makes sense for both parties. You know, sellers want the highest dollar amount and buyers want the best deals, but we just need to balance that gap where both walk away happy and make money and are successful. You know, that's the main thing about our job and industry. It's, you know, handholding and trying to get these deals across the finish line to make all parties, you know, completely happy with what we've done. And if, and along the way, anything can happen, you know, where, you know, we spend 6, 8 months, 9 months, a year and a deal's gone south or, you know, people have backed out and what you just can't stop. You just got to start all over again. And, you know, and that's what's great. You know, that's when you push yourself and you just keep going. You don't stop.
Exactly. You know, and I think sometimes you have some buyers, especially maybe new buyers who have the misconception that, why do I need a broker? Why do I need an agent? You know, I can find hotels. I can log on, you know, and I think I understand this business enough. And so they may have the misconception that they can do it themselves. Or even in some cases, as a buyer, they may think, oh, well, why am I going to pay someone else, you know, to do this work for me? And so they might not understand that in most cases, the seller is the one who often pays the commission. And so it is best to have someone who is working on your interest and someone who can go essentially to bat for you to make sure that you're getting the best deal on that particular transaction. And so do not try to cut your broker or your agent out of the transaction, or out of the deal, because we are here to make sure that your interest is protected and we are not here just for a commission.
Excellent. Well, Jigar, King, thank you so much for sharing your insights. I know you're very busy and we appreciate you spending time with us and, you know, educating us and our audience on the hospitality market. Where can people find you if they want to get in touch? Email, social media?
Yeah, we're available in Nugent Advisory, you know, email, social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And then we also have our Nugent database as well, too, which, you know, clients can subscribe to as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, again, NugentADV.com. Or you can, for me personally, my email is kjeremiah@NugentADV.com. Or you can always give me a call or text at 602-405-2082.
Love it.
And I can be reached at 520-664-4091. And my email is kind of long. It's jigar.desai@newgenadv.com.
Well, thank you both.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one.
visit go.crexi.com/podcast. That's go.crexi.com/podcast and sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexi podcast on your favorite podcast app or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/crexi for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, we'll see you next time.